Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, in this episode, we continue our series looking at careers in the food industry. My guest today is Sive Moore, who has the fantastic job title of eco-nutritionist. Sive's interest in the environment goes right back to her childhood in Ireland and has seen her travel the world cooking in some of the most challenging environments on the planet. She has two master's degrees. She's worked for Greenpeace and the British Antarctic Survey and has a passion for sustainable food systems. She's also devoted much of her career to working on youth projects. I'm delighted to welcome to the podcast Sive Moore. Sive, you're an eco-nutritionist. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. This is great to be here.
Oh, it's fantastic to have you. Now, look, your interest in the environment goes way, way back. Now, I'm very wary of saying these next words for fear of digging in for a week-long interview packed with laughter and tears, but let's give it a go. Can you tell us about your childhood in Ireland?
Oh, I didn't realise we were starting a therapy session. No, it's great.
It does all go back
to that, doesn't it? I mean, like I'm sure many of your guests on the show can recount, our connection with food is from birth. So, even from everything my parents did, it was, I suppose, I used to call them kind of hippie foodies, but these days I suppose you would call them eco-gastronomes, which is that their life kind of revolved around sustainable food systems before we even had terminology like sustainable food systems. They kind of moved out of London for the good life. You know, there was that old TV show, and they bought a scrap of land in the west coast of Ireland. And their friends used the term free-range kids. They decided to raise us as free-range kids. And we were raised with, you know, growing organic veg in the garden, foraging, fishing, climbing apple trees. But also, I suppose my mum was employed in the food system. She worked by day in a health food shop, one of the first health food shops in Southwest Ireland, The Pantry. And I would go to work with her and help her, like, you know, packaging lentils when, you know, lots of other kids weren't eating lentils. And by night she worked in an Italian pizzeria that her friend ran. And so I was always surrounded by good food, wholesome, homemade. We were always cooking. My dad always grew a veg garden, and my mum, we would put to work picking the stones out of the carrot plot, and, you know, watering was a daily activity. And my mum grew herbs and sold them to local restaurants. I'm also from a very foodie town in Southwest Ireland. It's quite touristy. So I suppose there was the influence of being on a kind of a eco-gastronomy trail of Southwest Ireland on the Ring of Kerry in Kenmare. So I was just raised on good food.
I love the free range idea. And so is it true to say you basically grew up in a cabin in the woods?
Yes. Yeah, so I suppose also part of the good life and the kind of more alternative lifestyle was my parents hadn't completed university and were very much into self-sufficiency. Mm-hmm. My mum has actually said she always wanted her kids to have survival skills. So, we all loved Bear Grylls growing up, stuff like that. And it was like, she wanted us to have survival skills. And sometimes I joke and say, you know, you could have, why didn't you want me to have accountancy skill and teach me how to do a spreadsheet? That's also useful. But, you know, you go through school and you learn to couple the two. You know, you go through the rebellion, reject everything your parents told you. I'm going to go get a corporate job. But then realizing, oh, wait a second, they were onto something.
Mm. Was there a phase of rejection where I'm, you know, my kids started off eating literally everything on the planet. And then when they went to primary school, you know, the alpha kids refused to eat tomatoes. And so they came home saying, well, I can't eat tomatoes.
Yeah, of course.
People don't know. Did you have that at to some level in the way that you grew up?
Definitely. There was the white food phase. You know, I realized, my other friends were just eating white pasta, white rice. And I was like, I just want white pasta. Because we always had brown. It was always brown pasta, brown rice. I was like, where do we get all this brown stuff? But I guess because my mum worked in the health food shop, we were exposed to all these things. But, you know, ultimately couldn't deny it. Like a lot of young kids, I did love hummus. I just had homemade hummus and carrot sticks as snacks every day. And I love baking. And, you know, when you go out to a veg garden as a kid and your playtime is picking mange too, and, you know, I loved munching raw Brussels sprouts. So it also then became part of my identity at a very young age. Like, ooh, other kids don't like Brussels sprouts, but they're my favorite vegetable. So it was your way of being rebellious then also within your peer group, and kind of even from a young age, trying to introduce other kids to come and pick herbs in the garden, try this fennel, and it tastes like, you know, sweets.
And so I mean, were they demonstrably into sustainability, or was it sort of under the covers? Was it just accepted?
It was, I suppose there wasn't even the same terminology around at the time. So in the 90s, it wasn't the term sustainability, but it was like, I remember on the bookshelves, we had things like a book called The Fat of the Land. Mm-hmm. And I suppose there was like references to Rachel Carson's, or my dad, you know, grew up in London at the time of the pea soup, which is, you know, one of those pivotal moments in the environmental movement that I learned about early on in my degree, that was the realization of how intrinsically linked our human health is with our natural environment. And if you, you know, pollute the air, a lot of people suffer. So they were aware of all those things. But I suppose there was one element of my upbringing that frustrated me, because they are quite, how would you say, I suppose they didn't go to university, but I would say my parents were intellectual people, from, I suppose, quite a middle-class background in North London. They rejected it because of the politics in the UK at the time, in the 80s, with, you know, I suppose...
Pretty tricky time, yeah.
Yeah, they moved out, and to get away from some of the governance of the time, that's maybe somewhat similar to the governance we've had for a long time in the UK at the moment. Mm-hmm. But the frustration I had sometimes was, we had all these interesting books, we discussed all these interesting topics in the house, and, you know, a lot of their friends were involved in the alternative food industry, some alternative members of the community we were in, who were, I suppose, a lot of international, like other English, Dutch, German people, as well as some of the local Irish people, were engaged in more sustainable food systems. And there was like a farmer's market, and there were cheesemongers down the road. And partly to sustain yourself, you know, have to have multiple incomes in a rural area, the tourism, and working in restaurants. But there was sometimes a frustration when I was surrounded by people who were interested in the environment, and they say, oh, you know, it's awful, they've cut down that tree, or they're cutting down that patch of woodland. And I'd say, oh, why is that bad? And they say, you know, it's just really bad, because nature, it's great, we need nature and environment. But I was like, but why? And but why didn't always go deep enough for me. And it wasn't until I went to university and started to understand concepts like deep ecology and the intrinsic value of biodiversity and nature in and of itself, as well as the extrinsic value, and that we need it for ecosystem services. So to understand that complexity, there was always that desire for more, and also the frustration with, I suppose, my parents were quite politically minded, and they would get frustrated with the state of the government or the state of the decisions being made that were kind of destroying the rural Irish countryside and British. But though we weren't part of any sort of activist networks, because we were just isolated doing the kind of self-sufficiency thing, which is one way to reject the society you don't agree with. But another way, and if you want to be part of things when you're young, for me, was to get into then activism and to be part of the change, be the change you want to see in the world.
And so did that happen? Did you become an activist? Were you joined? I mean, I remember the marches that I went on. There was, I think it was partly because there was the possibility of snogging involved at the time. But, it was exciting, and it sort of made you feel like you had a place in the world. What sort of activism did you get up to?
Yeah, I suppose, like you said, finding your tribe. And I remember my parents telling me stories of being at Greenham Common and, you know, being on nuclear disarmament protests. And so when I was at university in St Andrews, which, you know, went from Southwest Ireland to kind of Northeast Scotland, but again, to another small, coastal, quite foodie, touristy community, there was actually a great sustainable food network in Fife. And there was a group called the Fife Diet. And I really attribute a lot to the work of Mike Small and the fact that Scotland had the Climate Challenge Fund, which wasn't in the rest of the UK, but was actually funding organisations like the Fife Diet to promote, they were promoting locavorism. So at the age of, you know, 18, I was on a stall with this woman that I didn't know at the time, was Joanna Blythman, who's, you know, a big name in food journalism. And
absolutely,
she's selling zaytun, like Palestinian products. And it's my first exposure to kind of issues in Palestine. And then I suppose one of my best friends, Inej, had been on the Arctic sunrise in the Mediterranean in her gap year. She'd coming from Portugal, and the most positive, proactive kind of person you're ever going to meet. And she just was like, well, I'm going to set up a Greenpeace Society in St Andrews. So I was there the year that the Greenpeace Society was set up. And from there, we had stalls and we were running Greenpeace campaigns, and I was involved in any kind of food sustainability project going. I had friends who set up a food cooperative. There was Pillars of Hercules local veg box scheme. So there were lots more of students getting involved in food citizenship. Yeah. And then, yeah, from there, I got involved with Greenpeace, and I've done actions, international actions, potentially carrying arrest and all sorts, because I was doing what I, you know, standing up for what I believed in, and taking it to another step, you know, taking it that one step further and to another level. But kind of my parents were always behind me on it. You know, they would never be the kind of parents who'd say, don't get arrested. They're like, yeah, go get arrested. if it's what you believe in, if it's, you know, the planet. So, yeah.
So it's clearly deep in your bones. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we need to talk about careers. Tell us about your first job in the world of sustainability then.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, where does it start? I mean, one role I had in St. Andrews, I mean, other than the voluntary kind of work like that, was there was a transition movement, Transition University of St. Andrews, and they were just looking for someone to help with a bit of promotion and like sticking up posters. And so by applying for that job and getting that part-time role, yeah, I had on my CV then a sustainability role. And then the internship at Greenpeace came about because I'd had this experience in the University of St. Andrews, and I'd gotten to go to a festival with the Greenpeace network. They were then looking for a festivals coordinator, and it was my dream job. So
yeah, absolutely.
Straight out of uni, and it was literally like before I finished my final exams, came down for an interview at the big headquarters of Greenpeace in North London. And yeah, I got the role because I was pretty passionate. But at that stage, I was moving towards sustainability in the creative industries. And I'd, you know, done a lot of my essays on the creative industries. Half of them were on food systems and half of them the creative industries. So I thought, I knew I had to work in sustainability, but I wanted to work in one of my hobbies and the things that I loved, which was food and the arts.
Yeah. So there's food and the arts, but you've sort of now gone towards nutrition. Why did you choose nutrition and sustainable food? Was that just a series of sort of random events, or was there a plan deep down in there?
There was a bit of a plan, I suppose. Yeah. When I was studying sustainable development, a lot of your first year of the degree is you're kind of getting bombarded with pie charts on where the carbon emissions coming from. And as we all know, you look at them and you go, okay, a big part of it is transport. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not an engineer and I'm not going to invent solar flight, you know, or carbonless fuel.
Yeah.
So the next piece of the pie, you know, food systems, which very linked to transport, was food. And I thought, I also spent a lot of time at university, I would say procrastinating, I called it, where
surely not.
Doing my essay, I would just bake a cake, or I would like get some reduced item in the shops and then turn it into something else, or be making sourdough. And you know, so I was kind of procrastinating from my essay by making food. And I thought, well, surely if this is what I really love doing, and I was reading all these papers and articles. I remember reading Livestock's Long Shadow and being like, oh, huh. So meat production has actually like got a really huge carbon footprint. And this is like in 2009.
Hmm.
So it was pretty early on before there was all this rhetoric around it. And I suppose I felt like, well, that is an area that is pretty untapped and couples my interests, my hobbies, and hopefully doing good in the world. Because, you know, they say if you do a job you love, you'll never work another day in your life. And technically, I've never really worked.
So you are an eco-nutritionist. Tell me what an eco-nutritionist is and what does a typical day look like for you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I suppose actually for the last 10 years, I called myself eco-chef.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose it's now merged with eco-nutritionist. And I would say that is because food and the environment are so intrinsically linked. You know, people's health and planetary health go hand in hand, the whole one health concept. So for me, it's like, I always used to say I'm a chef, an environmentalist first and a chef second. And so yes, there are lots of nutrition supplements out there. And yes, if someone is low in iron, it's good to recommend that you can eat red meat, but there's nuance to it. And I suppose if you're also thinking about the environmental impact of your diet, which I think a lot of us now do, and globally we need to, what are the most environmentally friendly ways to do that? So I would say, you know, I have a book out called Sustainable Kitchen, and in there we have a recipe for chicken liver pate. So there's a lot of byproducts and offal. You know, we know places like St. John and the nose to tail movement were great at bringing us back to fillet steak is all well and good if cows just had fillet steaks, you know, but there's all these other parts we're not using and byproducts. And we can get nutrients from very underutilized sources, you know, shellfish and mussels and oysters and, well, very expensive, but, you know, affordable. So you're looking at that Venn diagram of the economic, social and environmental perspective of how to have a balanced diet.
Yeah. And just as we're passing by it, give yourself a big plug for the Sustainable Kitchen. Where can you get it? And what's the byline for it? What's the elevator pitch?
Yes. So Sustainable Kitchen came about from a platform that myself and Abby Aspen Glencock cross-run, the Sustainable Food Story. And we wrote that in lockdown, and it's a kind of a practical guide. So as well as recipes, it's like up to 60 guides and only about 30 of them are recipes. But there's also all sorts of tips and hacks for how to be more sustainable in your kitchen, and even from home growing to getting involved in your community and activism to reducing food waste. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's not the only solution. We know we need to be tackling, you know, industry and government and policy, but it's a kind of an empowerment tool. I would call it an empowerment handbook and a starter guide to, if you want to get more interested, involved about sustainability in the kitchen.
Yeah. So just give us one of your actionable kitchen tips that that everyone should apply themselves to.
I would say reduce food waste where possible by knowing your fridge. Know your fridge as well as you know your mobile phone, you know, yeah. Look in it all the time. Oh, wait, what's that at the back? It's like, delete that app because it's taking up space and it's going to, you know, it's like, you've got to think of your fridge like that. It's important to not just let things rot in the fridge and buy too much. And it's hard to remember, but, you know, meal planning where possible and seeing the potential, you know, like Doug McMaster from Silo says, waste is a failure of the imagination. So be creative. Just trust that, throw those herb stems in that NutriBullet that you never use under the, you know, sink, and you can turn it into something and it'll probably be delicious. Or it was a fun experiment and you've killed some time instead of scrolling through social media.
Yeah, but you might discover something amazing. You know, chuck your kimchi and your rhubarb crumble and who knows what joys might be uncovered.
Well, Maisie Collins at Hearth Bakery is making kimchi puffs and she puts them in a sausage roll format. They're delicious.
Beautiful. Fantastic. Okay, can you explain to me the concept of a sustainable regenerative system in the context of the food industry? So how can we create closed-loop systems that promote sustainability? Because it's a tricky one. It's a relatively new concept, I guess, that we should, but also that we can do these things. What is it that people are missing? What's the advice that you find yourself giving over and over again?
I mean, yes, it's a relatively new concept, but it's also millennia old. If you think back to, you know, indigenous knowledge that has for a long time been overlooked for big jazzy tech solutions, which are also great, but permaculture design, I suppose a lot of those old ideas of the closed loop in the small scale. So like we mentioned in the book a lot, is from your food waste scraps and having a compost heap and putting it back into the soil and nurturing your soil. And that's where, you know, the veganism question is difficult, because if you have a small homestead and you've got chickens and your chicken manure goes onto the land, but then at the larger scale, looking at that in more of an industrialized food system, which, you know, we do have for efficiency purposes, linking up organizations, you know, okay, we've got this byproduct, who can use this? I know at the moment the Sustainable Restaurant Association were looking for something to do with whey, and a lot of people, you know, think whey protein, we've heard of this whey stuff, but it's like, it's great if you can use it and it doesn't use more energy than throwing it away, you know, that's where it gets hard, and find innovative ways to get the best out of it without having very long supply chains. But it does take a lot of thinking. But I think it has to be cradle-to-cradle design. There was a book that we studied at university, Braungart and McDonough's Cradle to Cradle, Not Cradle to Grave. So before you start even inventing or developing the product, think about the end use as well, what's going to happen afterwards, as well as where it's all the, you know, materials coming from.
Absolutely. Now, obviously, you've grown up with a sort of like radical, individualistic sort of upbringing, but you've also worked and looked at the industry as a whole. What changes or improvements would you like to see the food industry make in the next decade? What are the obvious things to you that you're just screaming out to be changed?
So I suppose I heard the word in there, individualist, but I think of it as collectivist as well, because food systems, a lot of things in our life, becoming so individualistic where we are just making decisions for ourselves, I suppose, then it's not thinking of the greater good and the broader community. And as we learned from COVID and like a lot of public health messaging, we have to think of community as a whole. So I suppose my background with Global Generation, I really am quite an advocate of urban food growing spaces, well, as well as rural, and everyone having access to growing. So whether that's in schools, that you've got a growing plot, or that you've got community gardens, or more access to land. I know there are networks who are reclaiming golf courses or disused sites, brownfield sites, container growing, but having access to growing, learning about growing, learning about our food system, where our food comes from, and then processing it, you know, having access to kitchens in schools, not being afraid to let kids loose on knives, which I know a lot of the time I've taught cookery classes and kids say, oh, I'm not allowed to use knives. I'm not allowed to. And it's like we know that we kind of go a bit too far with things, the pendulum swing, and it's like bubble wrapping to the point that kids then can't get their hands dirty. You let kids just play in dirt, let kids play with their food. I know people say don't play with food. I'm all for play with your food.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're right.
And that's how you discover new things, and that's how you, you know, so interactive, yeah, getting everyone involved in the food system at some level.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your career. You've worked as a chef in the Antarctic. Antarctic or Arctic?
Antarctic.
Yeah. Antarctic, that's even more horrible. And you're currently involved in conservation efforts in the Congo. Mm. I mean, these are challenging extremes you're juggling about with here. In terms of logistics of eating well, what challenges do you face, and what challenges are actually common in every situation?
Mm. I would say a lot of chefs would agree that common to every situation is you can please some of the people some of the time. You can't please all of the people all of the time. Mm-hmm. And nutritionally, I make it a priority that, well, we have to please everyone nutritionally because you're kind of isolated in these places. So you're providing a nutritionally balanced array of foods. Mm-hmm. But it is quite a struggle. I mean, from the Antarctic, you go from using a lot of frozen and preserved and canned foods and dried things to in the Congo, you've got the issue of when you can get access to fresh food, you know, with this insecurity and road logistics issues, when you get access to the fresh food, not always having the processing methods available. You're running off generators and your freezers can break down, and, you know, trying to freeze things and preserve things to make sure you have a broad enough variety of food. You know, I try to get my 30 plants a week, and just accessing a variety of nuts and seeds and pulses as well as, you know, fresh produce. There are huge logistical challenges. So trying to balance, again, the nutritional needs and the environmental considerations as well as people's well-being, it always comes back down to, I suppose, in sustainable development, we think of the Venn diagram of balancing the three economic, social, and environmental considerations. Mm. So I'm always thinking in that way, the trifecta of,
trying to find the sweet spot in the middle there. Mm. Yeah. So what about your experience working with youth charities such as the Skip Garden? How have these shaped your perspective on I guess, sustainable food education? Because sustainability can get pretty boring pretty quickly for children. Mm. You know, you can hit it once and they'll be fascinated. But, you know, you need to talk about these things over and over again, really, to get them under the skin. Mm. How the heck do you go about it and not lose them?
I having studied them at, you know, university level, I use quite frequently words like sustainability and biodiversity and ecosystems. And I have to remember and bring it back down to their level that that's not terminology that really means much to them. Yeah. But what is your priority when you're a kid? It's having fun. And I have to remember that that's also my priority. And so I really like having fun. So if I'm having fun, hopefully, generally, they're having fun as well. So it's making it playful, making it always, like, you know, interactive, of course, which is naturally when it's that kind of farm to table approach where you get to go pick the produce, clean it off, process it, you find a snail, like one of the most, and having interesting ingredients that they've never tried before. One of the biggest memories I have at the Skip Garden is when the kids discovered sorrel, which I think a lot of people probably haven't even tried, but it's this amazing like sherbet type green leaf, you know, really, probably really nutritious, like spinach, but it's so sour and tangy, and kids love stuff like that. Yeah. And the same with rhubarb. They love that tower, tangy sweetness. And it's huge. It's the size of an umbrella. And they would hold this rhubarb stalk and carry it like an umbrella. So just letting them play, letting them wander off, pick things, taste things, smell things. We've done sessions on like mindful eating. So engaging all your senses, letting them ask questions. And I suppose, like we know from a lot of development work as well, participatory is how you're going to get people on board. It has to be led from the communities, from grassroots. So asking them, okay, next week's session, what do you want to make? And if they say chicken nuggets and chips, sometimes we make that. But, you know, we did a whole vegan session. We made vegan chicken nuggets and we were using seitan and we talked about how you, the different ways you get chips crispy and that you can do chips in the oven. And then you just work with that. So I think respecting their views and, you know, always having fun methods and not too didactic. That's what I wrote my one of my dissertation was the didactic thing is one phrase I always love to reiterate is Feedback Global, you know, the organization doing a lot around food waste and sustainability. Their tagline was always, if you want to save the world, you have to throw a bigger party than the people screwing up the world.
Yeah.
So to get people on board, I love Greta Thunberg. I'm a big fan. She's such an inspiration. I wish I knew a girl like her when I was a teenager with my eco anxiety. But Abby and I, and the aim of the sustainable food story is always to have it fun and enjoyable and engaging. And that's when people will get on board with the thing and then find that tribe and be part of the solution.
Yeah, you got to draw people to you. You can't ever push them in the direction you want them to go. You got to,
And positive, and you know, messages work better than negative messages. Yeah,
absolutely. Okay, let's talk about a bit about your sort of academic journey. You talk about your MSc in Nutrition for Global Health, which came a few years after you initially left university. Tell us about the MSc, and are these things important? Would you recommend other people do things like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine's Nutrition for Global Health Masters is bloody hard. Like, it was tough for me. It was challenging. You know, I didn't come from a science background. My undergraduate MA in Scotland was actually arts. So I knew a bit about statistics and it's challenging, but I wanted to be well-rounded and I wanted to be able to understand, you know, like, you know, you can feel, you know, intrinsically, like, we all need to eat more plants. You know, before there's microbiome research saying we need 30 plants. So we, you know, you just know it's good for you eating the rainbow, but it's hard to be able to always say why. But then to go to do a degree like that where you're then understanding the science behind how you prove that eating the rainbow and polyphenols and colourful things are actually good for you.
So it's about biochemistry and a fair amount of sort of evidence-based research as well.
Yeah, the evidence-based research, but also I suppose I'd always had an interest in, you know, the international development side of things. You know, the cliche when you're a kid and you're like, I'm going to cure world hunger. It's like, well, no individual does. But to work towards that and to know that there are degrees out there that facilitate working in all different levels of international development. I suppose I always thought I want to work internationally, try my hand at humanitarian world, and LSHTM is an amazing university for that.
Yeah.
And One Health, and, you know, I was there when COVID hit and it's quite amazing, you know, when all of a sudden everyone knows what epidemiology, and it's not skin, you're not studying skin, are you? No. So it's suddenly very relevant.
Yeah, absolutely.
And zoonotic diseases, and that's very relevant now, you know, understanding topics like that now, being based in the middle of the Congo rainforest where there's issues with bushmeat consumption and it's one of the only protein sources, but weighing that up with our knowledge of the disease risk and so, and alternative proteins and it was a great degree. I mean, it was a big cost as well. That is a big consideration.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's not easy to save that up. In London, I was very fortunate to be able to live with a wonderful lady called Jenny in London, and she has been like my patron and has supported me through having this patchwork career of just prioritizing doing what I love. But I suppose, yeah, you could say it's a bit of luck and obviously a lot of hard work, that if you're passionate enough about a thing, you find a way to make it work. So for me to have this very varied career, it has worked because of, you know, other factors.
Yeah. So advice for people starting out on a career related to food. I mean, is a patchwork career a stressful thing to have, you know, being a freelancer rather than working for a company? And what were the key things that led you to enjoying what you do?
Mm. Yeah, I'd say, is a patchwork career stressful? I mean, that's, you could ask the others way around. Is having a 9-to-5 Monday to Friday in a big corporation stressful? Yes, they're both stressful. Jobs are stressful. It's hard. Mm. But if you're doing something you love, you can rationalize.
Every day's a holiday.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of, I think also it works well with, I suppose I'm realizing more recently, I'm probably pretty ADHD, neurodivergent, and I'm not great at sitting still. And I was never going to be full-time desk-based. And I needed to be doing hands-on, tangible, applied work. So if you know, and patchwork can work well for that, but you'd have to be then organized. So then it pushed me to get really organized, get better at my scheduling. And I would definitely recommend, there's always support out there. You know, I've had charities I've worked with or have supported me to have life coaching sessions. And that was just a bit of like helping me do my scheduling and keep all my plates spinning and, you know, get that kind of support where you need it. And sorry, the second part to your question after that, well, there was the patchwork career and then there was the...
Well, advice for people that are starting out with a career in food, you know, what were the key things, the key bits of advice that you could give people for to be happy with what they do?
I mean, cheesy cliche, but I do kind of live by that phrase, you know, how you live your days is how you live your life. I mean, if your day to day is, oh God, I can't bear to go to work, or the daily grind, yes, I understand the money comes first and you need to be paying the bills, but if it's really making you unhappy and you're dreading it, you will find something else. It's trusting that you'll find something else. And if that means, yes, I did spend a lot of weekends volunteering. I'm volunteering with organizations that I loved and cared about. And it didn't feel like work. It was just stuff I was interested in, or going to an evening talk and doing the networking and doing the getting chatting to people and finding out, you know, that there are opportunities to do a bit freelance of this or that on the side, and if it can work to do two part-time things, you know, and if you're working in a place where you're not really enjoying it, and can you bring it down to part-time and then find something part-time that you enjoy more? Because I suppose in London we talk a lot about the side hustle, but a lot of people's dream is to make the side hustle the main hustle, and that was kind of always it. And I never just really saw it as a hustle. It was just like freelancing.
That's what you're born to do. And the MSc, I mean, was that essential for you to be able to do what you're doing now?
I would say not essential. I could be in the exact same place I'm in without it, but I love learning. So I suppose I don't always see doing a degree as a means to an end for a certain job. I did think, you know, I'll go to research. I'm never probably going to be a PhD type, but I like being able to have that evidence base behind the work that I do, even if it's not always very highly paid or if it's just charities. It's like, I think the confidence you want to be able to instill in a parent when you're teaching a children's cookery class and they're asking you a question like, ooh, my kid's really fussy and doesn't eat this, and what should they eat? I want to be able to know that I'm not giving false evidence. And, you know, my nutrition master's was accredited with the Association for Nutrition. I want to be able to say that I feel confident, even in just being a kid's cookery class teacher, that I'm not giving false advice of something I learned on Instagram. You know, it's genuinely like there's an evidence base for this. And similarly, that this is a better option for the environment. Well, of course, it depends what you're optimizing for, carbon, water, you know, but that I can understand those nuances. But I love learning. I think I'll be a lifelong student. And that is part of, you know, I suppose, enjoying your job as well, being able to learn and have challenges.
Yeah, which really leads on straight to my final question, really, which is, what's next for you? Do you have a five-year plan? Because you don't need to, and it's not important necessarily. But are there areas that you want to explore? And is there something you would like to be doing in 10 years?
I mean, there's lots of stuff I kind of miss from being a chef. I mean, I loved running kind of big community events, disco soups, and working with groups like the National Food Service and the kind of food activism on the ground. I would love to be doing more of that again in the future.
Yeah.
I suppose when COVID hit, Abby and I with the sustainable food story, you know, it took a bit of a backseat because we've been doing supper clubs and catering events.
Yeah.
And so that's how we kind of ended up going off in separate directions with our careers. But I loved, you know, I would never change it. I loved being in the Antarctic. It was an amazing opportunity. I could imagine going back to the Antarctic. I suppose it got me into the idea of expedition chefing. So to be able to, you know, I'm on the books of the British Exploring Society, and they have roles where I'd love, and VSO, and you know, people often say, if you were a millionaire, if you just won the lotto tomorrow, you know, what would you do? Would you give up your job? And I just think, if I won the lotto tomorrow, I would still do what I do, but I'd be able to do it for free. I'd be able to volunteer in all these places, and I'd set up my own food foundation that, you know, I would just work with all these organizations to strengthen them, because there are lots of them out there now. You know, when I was first coming into food sustainability, they just didn't exist, because I saw in the US there was Good Food Jobs website. Now we've got Roots to Work, you know, Sustain have a whole website of jobs if you want to work in good food.
Yeah.
And organizations and festivals like Groundswell or Shambhala, or, you know, you can couple your hedonism now with your food sustainability.
Yeah, there's absolutely. Like
exhibitions at the V&A on food and nature. And so it's everywhere. And it's really inspiring to see. And I think, yeah. I'm glad it's all growing. It's growing.
You're fizzing with enthusiasm. And so, well, your inspiration is catching. So thank you very much. Your expertise is fantastic to hear. And I hope that a lot of people are inspired by what you do to follow the same kind of route. So Sive Moore, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been great.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, we'd like you to join us in our new initiative, Sustainable Food Week, where we're celebrating the influential people changing the future of food. There are a number of ways to get involved. We've got a digital digest, an in-person forum, and podcast opportunities. It's happening between the 18th and 24th of September. But if you want to be involved, you need to act now. Find out more on the Food Matters Live website or email us at info@foodmatterslive.com. And thank you so much for listening.